Hello everyone. We are continuing with the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, Swami Kriyananda's articulation of Yogananda's commentary. We are in the fourth chapter. We'll be starting with the fifth stanza of the fourth chapter. But first we're going to pray for guidance. As I was saying before we started this, sometimes I feel highly unqualified to be giving this class because the power and the subject matter of the Gita is just simply beyond my experience. But fortunately, the scripture applies to all levels of consciousness, so I will simply approach it from where I stand, and presumably we'll be able to get something valid out of it. I hope at the end of this hour you'll agree with me. So, dear friends, let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to attune our consciousness with thy ray of wisdom and grace, that we may understand heart, mind, and spirit the whispers of your guidance. Help us to translate scriptural words into real understanding and realization, that our spontaneous responses to life may grow to be perfectly guided, perfectly attuned, following of thy infinite voice within. Om, peace. Amen. Let's have just a few minutes of meditation and then we'll start. Om peace. Amen. Okay, friends. We are, as I said, on chapter 4, verse 5. We are in the chapter of the book called The Supreme Science of Knowing. It's chapter 16 of the book, although only 4 of the Gita. I have a new pair of glasses, and I have to see if I can see through them. Oh, great. We're going to read chapter 4, verses 5 through 8. The Blessed Lord said, this is, of course, Krishna speaking, and he's speaking to Arjuna, many have been my births, and many also yours. I remember all of mine, though you remember yours not. Verse number 6. Though I, a fully liberated soul, am the Lord of all creation, and am in my true self, and abiding ever in my cosmic nature, forever unborn, yet I, by my yoga maya, assume from time to time an outward form. O Bharata Arjuna, whenever virtue, dharma, declines, and vice, adharma, is in the ascendant, I incarnate myself on earth as an avatar, appearing from age to age in visible form. I come to destroy evil and reestablish virtue. These are very, very famous verses from the Bhagavad Gita, because they set up the whole story of the nature of Sanatan Dharma. This is one of the, whenever I'm giving a class about Christianity, and I'm trying to explain the avatar of Jesus. I'm using avatar in that sense because it means the descent from the infinite, the descent of Jesus into human form, of God into the form of Jesus. And I'm trying to explain how unusual the Western point of view is and how, without context, the difficulty, what's happened with Christianity is it's without context. And the conclusion of the church, because there's no context for Jesus' birth, is that revelation began with Jesus and ended with Jesus. That he was a phenomenon that happened and then will never happen before and never will happen again. And when I'm trying to explain to people how there's another perspective on it, it's this verse, from time to time, when virtue declines and vice predominates, I, the Infinite Spirit, take visible form on earth. The irony of the incarnation of Jesus, which is gradually being rectified by a greater understanding of the life of Jesus himself, was that those missing years of Jesus from the age of 12 until the age of 30, when he appeared on the scene, which is the missing 18 years. Master said unequivocally that Jesus was in India during those years. And it's become almost common knowledge now that during those 18 years, he didn't just live with his parents and become a carpenter in his father's shop, that he was conducting an entirely other ministry. One finds it talked about as just the calm truth in all kinds of strange forms. I've referred to this children's book that I read, and I have not been able to find it again. And if anybody listening to this can find it for me, I would be very grateful. It was published by a Catholic publishing house, and it was published, I believe, by an Irish or a Welsh writer-illustrator. And it was about among other themes, it was about a secret brotherhood of sages, and the three wise men were a part of that, and they came to visit Jesus as a child. This is exactly what Master says. And then at the age of 12, Jesus went with Joseph of Arimathea, and Joseph of Arimathea was one of the wealthiest people of that time, and there's other stories about him, that he was a trader, that he had, not traitor, but one who traded in goods, and that he had ocean-going vessels, and he was widely traveled. He took Jesus, and they took a long journey, which went for a long time to India, in which Jesus visited other sages, including the three wise men who come to visit him. It's exactly the story that Master tells, except this story even embellishes it even more. And it was a children's book, and it was published by a Catholic publishing house. And for the life of me, I did not dream it. It really happened. But I've never been able to find it again. But when I read that, I thought, my, this is really becoming just what people say. They just talk about now. It's an interesting fact of science, so I've been told, reading about great scientists. Swami was fond of saying it, and he quoted the name of some very well-known scientist that I no longer remember, who said, he said, it's not really that living scientists become convinced of a new theory. He said, what happens is that a new generation of scientists grow up with that new theory, and it just becomes accepted knowledge. And I was thinking that spiritually speaking, you know, many of these things are becoming just accepted knowledge, so a new generation of truth seekers just takes it for granted. So the entire difficulty with Jesus is that they do not understand what an avatar is. And out of pious devotion and a misunderstanding of the esoteric meanings of many things that Jesus said, you end up with Jesus as a singleton who never went through a process of sadhana, and there was never anyone like him before, and his words, like the only Son of God, are not understood in the esoteric sense. So the commentary here that Swami is giving, especially to this last verse, is absolutely essential for understanding all religions. And once you understand this, then it's very easy to see a unity in religion, because this is the unifying factor. Master put it that self-realization is the unifying reality among all the world religions. And that's, he didn't mean self-realization, the organization he founded. He didn't mean that SRF per se will become the Catholic Church of the future and everyone will be members of that. He meant the impersonal principle of self-realization. And what that implies, the principle of self-realization leads to the whole of Sanatana Dharma. What is the self? Who am I? How is it realized? What is the progression of self-realization in the course of a lifetime? And then it leads to what happens after we're self-realized, which leads to the understanding of what is an avatar. Why does an avatar come? How does a person become, how does one reach the stage of consciousness that one could be an avatar if it was one's destiny to be so? Then it begins to explain the founders of all the true religions of the world. And once you've really understood the principle of self-realization, you can then enjoy the unity and the diversity. It doesn't mean that the multiple expressions of divine understanding will all be unified under a single expression, but we'll suddenly understand that the multitude of expressions are like the fingers of a hand or the individual jets of flame on a gas burner. The fuel comes in, it goes through those specified holes, and then you have all these individual jets of flame. Each one stands on its own, but you understand that they all emanate from the same source. Or looking at a beautiful stained glass window, which can have a vast variety of colors and shapes, but what animates them is one sunlight. Undifferentiated sunlight gets broken apart into all those small pieces, but when you step back, what is the animating force? The animating force is the same. And this is where we're trying to go as a global culture, as we rise into Kali Yuga. The advantage of being in a rising age is that wisdom will increase as time passes. Being in a declining age, which, as it happens, the Bhagavad Gita was written at approximately the same place on the spectrum, except the Bhagavad Gita was in when we were descending from the higher age of Dwapara into the darker age of Kali. And right now we're exactly opposite on the ellipse, but we're on the ascending side. So we're coming out of this fragmentation into unity. I don't know which is more depressing, honestly. The advantage of the descending age, which, depending on my mood at the time, sometimes the advantage of the descending age is you get to turn your back on the whole world because there's no possibility of building something that will last. Everything's going to be obliterated by the Philistines, you know, as you get lower and lower in the age. So there's no point in trying to build. Preserve, yes. Protect, yes. Hide away, yes. But it's why the whole teaching of Kriya and all of that just went into the Himalayas. It wasn't lost. It was just hidden because the mass of humanity wasn't interested, and it wasn't even safe to give them access to that kind of power. But starting with Lahiri, appealing to Babaji to bring it back into the world, now here we are again. So Swamiji starts explaining to us, people talk about the avatars being incarnations of Vishnu. This is the Indian tradition. Now, I'm not able to speak with great authority like someone raised in that culture could. That's also helpful because all I can gain is the essence of what Swami says. And he makes the comment that Vishnu is not actually a person. Now, it's an interesting comment, and I'm just going to go over here, and I don't have Swami with me to explain this. But there are other gods and goddesses in the Indian pantheon, so to speak, personifications of ideals of divinity. The god Agni, for example, who's the god of fire. Swami remarked once, or Indra, who's the lord of the heavens. Swamiji quoted Master once as saying that these are actual cosmic realities. And he said that that the image that Swami gave us is there's always, for many centuries, there will be a king of England, but different souls will play that role. So there will be the position of the king of England, and then various souls will incarnate to play that role. And the implication was that somewhere in the cosmos, and this is where I said at the beginning, I'm so far beyond my pay grade in talking about these, so I'm just going to present this as it was presented to me. Somewhere in the cosmos, many of these deities actually exist, and different souls take those roles for a period of time and then act out what exactly, I couldn't possibly say. So we all have to meditate and reflect on these. I've become quite convinced that whatever Master asserted is truth. If I don't understand it, I don't reject it. I just kind of go, isn't that fascinating? And then try to just run it through what little mental power I have and what little bit of meditation-born intuition I can muster to just see where it leads me, because this world is made up of much more than we know. But talking about these avatars being incarnations of Vishnu, Swami does not explain it in that way. He says that Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva are three aspects of the vibration of Om. Now, maybe in the way I was describing, there is also a deity who acts himself out, who calls himself Vishnu. I have a statue of Krishna that's very dear to me that I bought in Varanasi many, many years ago. And it has four arms. And when I bought that statue, I was traveling on pilgrimage. Actually, I think it was the second or third pilgrimage. So that would have been 87, 88, 89. And I had gone into the statue shop in the basement of, in a basement, I say, because it was downstairs. Now, actually, maybe I bought it right at the, and I'm a little confused, because I bought a Ganesha statue. The Ganesha statue I bought having seen it for 2 years, and then I finally bought it. But the Krishna statue, I believe I walked downstairs and I saw it, down the stairs into the shop, and I saw it, and it was immediately, it's just right here. I'm going to just have to reach over and show it to you. Oops. A little complicated, but I couldn't not show it to you. So this is my statue of Vishnu, of Krishna. And I didn't actually realize when I bought it that it was a forearm statue. I bought it entirely because it wanted to come home with me, is the only way I can think about it, and because I loved its face. And I had to carry it, hand carry it home, because I didn't trust it to be packaged in my luggage. So it was wrapped, and I carried it like a baby, like this, except it was all wrapped in paper. And Krishna and I traveled through India together, and then I brought him home. And this was my, I believe it was my first trip to India. Yes, I just bought him on the first trip. And when often at the airports, he would have to be unwrapped. And when he was in my room, he was always, my hotel rooms, he was always unwrapped. And then people would come up and say, "Ah, Mahavishnu, Mahavishnu Krishna, Mahavishnu Krishna." Maha means great. Vishnu. And it took me a while to realize that was because he had four arms, which, as I said, I hadn't even noticed. So this particular one, of course, many statues of Krishna only have him with his two human arms, but mine is a Mahavishnu Krishna. Swamiji always liked that statue, which was nice to have my own. I'm going to say something. Looking at the face of it, just because I'm looking at it, I'm going to hold it up. When we would travel in India, people would have in their minds that they were, for about 20 years, not every year, maybe I think 12 or 13 times, we took pilgrimage groups to India, mostly Americans. And people would often have in mind, I'm going to buy a Shiva statue, I'm going to buy a Krishna statue, something like that. I didn't have in mind to buy this, I just saw it, and it was mine, ours. But I would often watch that people would go all over India and then they would finally buy a statue. "Oh, I found the most beautiful one," statue they would say. There were like 30 of us and we were, you know, like a real close family. We traveled for 28 days. And then they would, "Oh, here's my Shiva statue," and they'd bring it to dinner and show you. Many times, not always, but many times, the statue they would buy would look like the person who bought it. There would just be like a quality to the face. The reason I put this here is because I don't see my own face in Krishna's face, but many times I would see the face of the person who bought it. And it would just, it always struck me in such a deep way, because of course we make a face that makes sense to us, that feels like we feel at home with it. And we're not really that familiar with our faces, most of us, unless you're a model or something like that, where you, or an actress, where you really have to study your face. But there's a certain sort of resonant familiarity. So it would always amuse me. That's what I said. It would sort of, like you would see it and you would recognize somehow this belongs to me, because it really would belong to you. And it was like we are all made in the image of God, and then sometimes God isn't made in the image of us. Now, as I said, by no means was it always true, but a surprising number of times it turned out to be true. So much so that whenever someone would be excited about a statue, I would just sort of look at it closely. Sometimes I'd point it out. Sometimes I would just be amused in my own heart, depending on how it was. Now, coming back to this. So, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva are the... There's three aspects to Om. Om is the vibration of the universe. It's the spirit made manifest. It's in the beginning was the word. It's talked about in many places. I don't have to teach the concept of Om here. And Om is said to have three aspects. Brahma is the creator, Vishnu is the preserver, and Shiva is the destroyer. Because if you think about the cycle of creation, that's how it's always going, isn't it? It's always being recreated, then it's maintained for a period of time, and then it dies away. I mean, that is our life cycle. We're born, we exist, we cease to exist. This just goes on and on. Several people in my world have been diagnosed with the kinds of illnesses that often lead to the end of the body. And, you know, it's a very interesting thing when the Shiva energy comes. It just comes. In our society, we have what Daniel Brinkley called life greed, where even when the soul is trying to separate from the body, we try to just squeeze out a little more. One of my friends, she was the only child, and she had to care for her mother for a long time, and her mother was very difficult, just very difficult. And her mother was very frugal to the point of miserly. And the mother just lived on and on and on and on. And the daughter ruefully said that her mother was so frugal that she refused to give up that body until she had squeezed every possible breath out of it. It was finally, of course, I mean, at a certain point, it passes. Now, the reason avatars, one of the reasons the avatars are considered to be Vishnu is because when virtue declines and vice predominates, the avatar comes in to preserve Dharma. It comes in to make sure that Dharma endures. And it comes to move the shadow aside and keep the light going. It's not like it starts something new. It just takes that which has always been true, Sanatana Dharma. Sanatana Dharma is sometimes called the eternal religion. And the eternal religion, the nature of it would be that it's just always the same. And some translations, trying to get the nuance of the word Sanatana Dharma, call it that which is. That's my favorite. Because that which is just removes any vestige of sectarianism. It just simply is that which is eternally true. And civilizations rise and fall, incarnations come and go, you know, tyrants are born, rule for a time and are destroyed, you know, vice gets a foothold and then virtue is restored. But it just, there's that which is always there. It's the endless, it's the never-ending drama of the jiva seeking its home in the divine. And whenever the shadow gets too strong, the avatar comes to make it bright again. And so he's always an aspect of that divine play, just bringing the light, returning the light, pushing the shadow away. I love in cosmic, in the Samadhi poem, Master says, vanish the veils of light and shade. And of course, in the mind, you think of light and dark. And it's just there's light and then there's dark. But if you say light and dark, then you're talking about dark as having a reality that's equal to light. It's like there are these two things. There's light and there's dark. Just like there's male, there's female. You know, like the sun rises and the sun sets. And you see those, even like day and night, they're two realities that happen. So the mind thinks light and dark. But Master says light and shade. And what shade is, shade does not diminish the light. Shade occurs when something blocks the light. So even just right in that very first line of that poem is just right there. And so that's why also it's more true to say light and shadow. And so what happens when vice is beginning to ascend is that this tumultuous energy that is contrary to that which is begins to gain ascendance. It's like it's literally like a dark shadow just growing up. And as it grows up, it blocks the light. It blocks the light literally in that evil deeds are done upon the earth. It blocks the light because it's harder for people to see it. But the light itself is never diminished. I am reading a book. I'm always so enthusiastic that I tend to recommend books when I just start them. And then sometimes it turns out as I read farther that, but I can't help myself. I'm at the beginning of this book, the name of which is called Everyday Saints, and I can't remember who the author is, but it's a Russian name. This is translated from the Russian. It's a relatively new book. In the last 15 years book. And it's this Russian monk, and he's right in the Russian Orthodox Church, and it's modern times, last 50 years. And he's just writing about his brother monks, all of these sort of very little known, deeply devoted souls, many of whom are really quite remarkable. And he just tells stories about their lives, and they're just marvelous. And one of the reasons I was actually interested in this is because many of these souls carried out their spiritual life through the very atheistic communist era in Russia, and yet still managed to maintain their spiritual life, although some of them went to the gulag. Some of them were imprisoned even for long periods of time during the worst of that oppression, and the monasteries were often, it's sort of hard to understand because I didn't live there and he doesn't bother to explain it, but you know, there was sort of a delicate balance between this extremely atheistic anti-religion government and the religious organizations, which just seemed to keep going through this. So I don't know how that balance was maintained, but the point here is one of the very, very saintly souls that he described, whose name happened to be John. Most of their names, that's why I can't remember it, or names like I don't recognize, because it's not my culture, but he was 8 years in the 50s in a gulag. And that was not well known by the author of the book, who met him much later, but then it came out. He eventually learned. And the man was tortured, and many, many terrible things happened to him. But the father, the monk, said, "It was the happiest period of my life," he said, "because there was a fervor to my prayers that I've never been able to match since then." And he said, "I know that difficult and bad things happen to me, but I can't remember any of them." He said, "All I can remember is how very close I felt to God during that time." So, you see, shade, vice can predominate and shade can come in, but shade is only blocking the light. And therefore, if with the grace of God, that's the only thing you would have to call it, if with the grace of God you can penetrate that shade, you'll discover that the light is always there. And interestingly, the same comment was made by Immaculée Ilobagiza, who spent 7 months, no, I don't think it was 7 months, I think it was 3 months, but I might be mistaken, but it was some months, with seven women in a small bathroom during the genocide in Rwanda. And she was hidden by a very brave friend who hid all these women in this small room and kept it hidden. It was in his own house, and he kept it hidden from his family that they were there, because it was too dangerous for anyone to know. And meanwhile, her entire family was slaughtered, and all of her people were slaughtered. And she survived with the Bible. But, of course, it was extraordinary. It's hard even to think about these things. But she said, you know, "I've never felt so close to God." So it's very, very hard to understand the balance of light and shade. And there's a natural fear of being put into circumstances like that. But there's also a natural grace if God so chooses to put you there. These are things I am saying to encourage us all. I do not see coming to us immediately the possibility of having to endure those kinds of conditions. But this is being recorded in the year 2020, and we don't quite know what the future is in the USA where I'm living. Things are very uncertain, so the mind goes in lots of directions. The reason I was interested in the Russian book was, you know, in America we're so comfortable. We're just so accustomed to the rule of law, many of us, depending on the color of your skin, I have to say that fairly. But a person such as myself, I felt exceedingly secure in this country. What if that changes? You know, how do we how do we penetrate the shade? How do we participate in the work of the avatars to increase dharma and decrease adharma? Is it just within our own hearts? Do we take action? All of these are very, very important questions. Now, Swamiji addresses the issue because Sanatan Dharma, see, one of the principles of Sanatan Dharma, which is exceedingly important, is that an avatar, Buddha, Krishna, Rama, Ramakrishna, Yogananda, Babaji, any of these avatars, even though they now have attained a state of oneness with God, at one point they were a jiva moving through the stages of self-realization, just like you and me. I get tremendous solace from this fact in this way. Master is reputed to have said that he remembers all the way back to his individual consciousness being a diamond. Now, the practical mind says questions like, was he the whole uncut diamond, or was he just a small diamond that was already made in the shape? And then what happened to the other pieces of the diamond? I can't answer any of those questions, and Swami isn't here, and Master isn't here to answer. But what Master is really trying to say is that he came through every stage of evolution that any jiva comes through. Now, if you don't think of it in terms of was Master an American in California in the year 2020, because here's an interesting question. An attorney that I was working with one of Ananda's attorneys who got to know us well, asked me a question about reincarnation that I'd never considered. He said, can you incarnate backwards in time? Can you live in modern America now and then medieval France? And then with the American Indians, and he only asked if you can go backwards in time, not can you go forwards. How did I know? But fortunately, I could ask Swami these questions. His answer was interesting. No, he said, you incarnate progressively in time because incarnating in a material body is within the realm of time. So because you're in the realm of time, you're bound by the rules of time. So it isn't as if Master has to be exactly here, but my incarnation as Asha, born in 1947, all the things that happened to me, everything that I've been through in this lifetime, is a vibration of consciousness. I mean, just like if you look at a piano, each note is a certain, whatever, however they define it, but there's an actual number, the vibratory number of whatever the sound wave is, each one represents a certain measurable sound. In the same way, or by the same principle, the consciousness that I have, or the consciousness I've been through in this lifetime, is a recognizable vibration of consciousness somewhere between complete delusion and God realization. And so every vibration, if the avatar starts at where everybody starts, he has to progress, because evolution for all of us is a seed that gradually grows. It's not like we're sort of here and then we can just skip all these stages. You've often heard me say this, but it's exceedingly important for our own equanimity as devotees, which is the seed has to go through every stage. It can't just become something it wasn't. It can't be the seed and then be the sapling. I use the apple seed and the apple tree because it's so obvious. But the seed will become an apple tree. The potential to be an apple tree is inherent within it, but it has to go through absolutely every stage before it can become an apple tree. If you sort of, cut it off as a sprout and want it to immediately be a sapling, it's impossible. It's not that which is. So we have to evolve through experience that we gradually realize higher and higher states of awareness. We realize them in this sense, that I understand that this will bring me greater happiness and help me to avoid suffering. And so it's not like a theoretical understanding. It becomes, this is how I respond to life, because every sentient creature has two desires. One is to escape suffering and the other is to experience happiness. And that's what drives us to God, because that which is irrefutable and consistent. That which causes suffering is irrefutable and consistent, and that which causes happiness is irrefutable and consistent. But Maya, the shade, comes in, and we get these really dumb ideas. Just like, I mean, Swami just used the word, we're just stupid, is what he said. We're just stupid. I mean, it only looks stupid afterwards. At the time, it always seemed like a good idea, or else we wouldn't do it. So we go through all those vibrations of consciousness, and whether we manifest it on this planet or another planet, whether we manifest it in a male or a female body, whether we manifest it as wealthy or poor, whether we learn it through physical suffering or through great success, or all of these in combination, which is more likely. Swami asked Master if we always incarnate on this planet, and Master laughed and said, oh no, there's countless planets to go to. If we need Kali Yuga descending, we have to go where Kali Yuga is descending. If Earth happens to be, you know, moving through Satya Yuga, and Satya Yuga is not helpful to us, we have to go someplace else. We go to the country and the culture and the time, and in the company of or in the absence of whoever and whatever. But all of it, if you could reduce it to mathematical formulas, you know, when we have this circumstance and these responses, is vibrating at 217 or whatever, however you want to think about it. It all reduces to metaphysics, which is the greater kind of physics. So Master, if he started as a diamond or whenever he wants to count his beginning, as a jiva, as an individualized spark of divinity, which is eternal, never changes, once that spark of divinity began its long incarnational cycle, to merge back into God, it goes up the entire keyboard. It goes through every single number, which means whatever I am experiencing, whatever thoughts are in my mind, whatever discipline or lack of discipline, whatever emotional reaction, whatever suppressed feelings, whatever fears, if I just translate it into a metaphysical formula of a certain number, somewhere on the scale between delusion and freedom, every avatar stood and vibrated exactly as I am vibrating. Now, what that does, if you can really take that deeply inside yourself, opens us up to a relaxed relationship with the divine. It's like we're reminiscing with our favorite uncle. Oh yeah, I remember when we were both kids and we went behind the barn and we smoked those cigars and we felt so nauseous. I mean, just think about it. You get with your friends. Oh, I remember a friend of mine. Let's see. Someone at Ananda. She went to visit her parents. This was ages ago, but she went to visit her parents and for some reason they went out to play miniature golf. You know, just something to do with your parents. So they were out there and they were playing miniature golf. My friend was already living at Ananda by now. She was probably 30. And she said something like, oh, this is fun. I've never done it before. And then a certain look went over her parents' face. And she remembered that when she was in high school and wanted to do something that her parents wouldn't have approved of, she always said that she and her friends were going to play miniature golf. It was like, there it was. And she sort of said, in the moment, even she couldn't quite just say, oh yeah, I lied to you for years. Instead, she said something, since I can't remember when. So it wouldn't actually be an untruth. But you know, when she was telling us this, I mean, of course, it's a ridiculous story and it really made us laugh. And sometimes kids with their parents, you know, there's a point in the relationship where you start telling them what you were really doing. I mean, now that it's really behind you, you can talk about what you were really doing, and now they don't have to be so scared because you're not doing it anymore. And the stories are often really, really funny because we're crazy when we're young sometimes. Some people are crazy and we just do all kinds of daft things. Now, imagine when life review comes, or even more when God realization comes, and it's just all behind us and it doesn't make any difference at all. And it's funny. I mean, the things that we do that are wrong always end up being funny stories, because I was just recently, you know, I'm 70, over 70 right now, and I have a good memory for a lot of things, but of course, the mental attic gets full and things get put at the bottom of the trunk, or they just fall out the window and you never know they're gone. But recently, I came to Ananda when I was 22, and I started remembering some of the things that I did in my 20s. I mean, I was totally committed to Ananda. I was totally involved with Swamiji, and I don't know what I was thinking. And I sort of have this sort of vague memory of these sort of odd expressions on Swamiji's face. I just don't know what I was thinking. But it made sense to me at the time, or else I would never have done it. But Master, Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, every one of them were right where you were. And it doesn't seem odd to them. It seems like, well, given your state of consciousness and given your level of experience and given your karma, what else would you do? And we are so ashamed and we're so embarrassed and we so think we have to give it to get. Among other things, I mean, we're just not. It's like your uncle went there too. That's what he did. He was exactly where you were. He was just as confused. He was just as heartbroken. He was just as angry. He was just equally bereft. He was just as undisciplined. His meditations were just as lousy as yours was this morning, mine was this morning, whatever it might be. We can't shock him. There's just no way to shock him. He knows it all. He's seen it all. Now, I remember with Swami once, he'd given me the job of running publications, which was not a good job for me, because to say I have no instinct for business is putting it in a very polite and mild way. I have many fine qualities, but running business is not one of them, which Swami gradually figured out also. And also, I didn't understand that competent people are competent because they accept input. I thought competent people came out of the womb completely capable and therefore never accepted input. So Swami was constantly trying to help me, and I just didn't. I mean, this is among the things that I did when I was in my 20s. I just didn't have any idea how to relate to it. So let's see, what was the point there? Let me try to think what the point was. Isn't that odd? It's completely gone out of my head. Oh, yes. So I had that job even for a couple of years, I think, but it was a total disaster. And someone said, oh, you ran publications. Yes, I said, yeah, I ran it into the ground. It was just awful. But he, because I wanted to appear to be a good disciple, I would say yes to everything Swami suggested, and then I did pretty much none of it. Because I was just incapable. I didn't know how to do it. And I wasn't comfortable enough with Swami or myself to let him help me. So I would try to put on a good front, and then I was just becoming increasingly chaotic inside. Fortunately, none of this is super clear to me, but what I mean is the memories are very... I remember this all happened, but I can't conjure any feeling for it because it's just come and gone. But there was a certain point at which Swami, it basically reached a crisis, because he was trying to teach me many things. Running a business was not one of them, but he was teaching me many things. He kept applying pressure, and finally it, like this. And he said, you wanted to appear to be a good disciple, but I could tell how upset you were inside. He said, you never fooled me. That was the phrase. And I looked at him and I said, oh my gosh, what a colossal waste of time then. Trying to present myself in a certain way when he He wasn't fooled. And I actually realized, of course, Swami had super conscious insight into me. Thank you, God. But we don't fool each other. You know, you put on a front that's a false front. Everybody can tell, but if you won't take it down, there's nothing your friends can do. They just have to live with it until you're ready to take it down. But from that point on, I at least tried. Not, it took me many years to be successful, to just be who I was, just whoever I am. And that's why I have such a strong feeling about God's not neither shocked nor dismayed. He's perfectly knowledgeable, and that's who we are. So this fact of the Master is a self-realized being. And most of the time, as Swami puts it, when a jiva finally gets out of here and really transcends all, well, yoga is the neutralization of the vrittis in the spine. And vrittis are the whirlpools of unfinished business. You know, things that we don't understand, what I call alternate theories of happiness. And all of those vrittis, every vritti represents some held belief, which is the center of a whirlpool of energy, and it's the magnetic center that keeps the energy whirling like this. A heartbreak that was unresolved, a revenge that was never gotten carried out, a desire for something that you haven't yet gotten, and you hold it, one holds it, because one believes I would be happier if I could satisfy it. You know, whether it's a dark desire to do something against someone who hurt you, or the way it came to me one day was, somebody owes me an apology. Just have somebody say, actually, you were right. I realized that there's just like, there was this whole huge generic bundle of vrittis. In the center of each one of them is, somebody owes me an apology. This sort of outraged, I was right and unrecognized, which I saw as a pattern in my incarnation, the one I'm living now. I was right but unrecognized. Somebody owes me an apology. And I saw that, oh my God, I've been doing this for lifetimes. And they never apologized to me, of course, so I just held these. I will be happier if they apologize. So it was my alternate theory of happiness, you see, that I was holding. Master makes the statement that every desire has to be fulfilled. And that seems like, how are you ever going to do that? But what that means is that every alternate theory of happiness except total surrender to God's will without a breath of hesitation. And we can only do that if we're not clinging to alternate theories of happiness. So Master isn't cursing us or anything like that. He's describing the metaphysics of it. As long as there's something held that I still need to alleviate my suffering and increase my happiness, exactly to that extent, I can't merge my consciousness with God. But when all of those are released, nobody owes me an apology. You know, I don't need to get back at anyone. There's nothing in this world that I want but God. That's why we sing, I want only thee, Lord, thee, only thee. And sometimes I love that chant, and sometimes my subconscious mind just mocks me when I sing it. It just kind of depends on the mood. But the affirmation of that, I want only thee, Lord, thee, only thee. I'm going to let go of every one of these vrittis. And that's what it is to be an avatar, is that, well, Jesus called it born without sin. Sin is a loaded word in English. I prefer the word ignorance or unlearned lessons. Every one of these vrittis is an unlearned lesson. An avatar has no vrittis. An avatar is just the pure light of God. They have one understanding, which is to do God's will. Now, that may cause them to be deeply committed in this world, because all the masters have the same consciousness. Every self-realized being has the same consciousness, but some of those jivas have big assignments. And that's why we tend to call them great masters, because they have a great mission. Jesus had a huge mission to carry out. Krishna, But there are many self-realized masters. Swami refers to one that he met in India, whom Master also met, who was completely free. He was a God-realized master, almost entirely unknown. His mission in the world was essentially non-existent. And his response was, God has done what he wants to do through this body. But Master had this magnificent mission, but he had no vrittis. So what he had was a responsibility. But he committed himself to that responsibility even more powerfully than someone with vrittis, because there was no conflicting cross-current of ego. In everything we do, there's this conflicting cross-current of ego. And the ego is these vrittis that we're still holding. A piece of us has to hold on to those alternate theories. And we can commit ourselves greatly to many, many things, but still we're holding this, but the master is holding nothing, nothing at all. And so they're fearless. They enter completely into the human experience. See, this is what's slightly confusing to us. They're much more human than we are. They feel everything much more deeply. They experience the ups and downs of this world without a filter, virtually. But they have no alternate reality that they're trying to assert. So their experience of this world is completely different. And it's not... All suffering is because we want things to be other than they are. And we sort of say common sense, but this is bad and this isn't. Well, everything is the same manifestation of God, so why is that bad? Because I don't like it, because I'm holding an alternate theory. And the masters aren't. But nonetheless, the master comes to restore the light, to maintain Dharma, to maintain the light. And so he has to do battle against that which shadows the light. So, you know, he's grappling constantly, and the shadow struggles against him to try to extinguish the power of that light. And the avatar has to be committed to carry this light. And the battle is huge on every level, causal, astral, physical. It happens all the time. I mean, all simultaneously, this constant battle. And there's these worlds that we can't see. Anandamayi Ma was famously known to just get up and move to another part of India. Before the age of the internet, Anandamayi Ma lived until 1982, which was actually before the age of the internet. But I never met her, but my friends who would go and see her, you would go to India and you would have no idea where she was in India. And you would have to just try to find out. And everybody who's visited Anandamayi Ma during the, who had that kind of experience, they'll tell you the story. And it's always, almost always, some miraculous story of coincidence after coincidence until they finally are drawn to her, because, of course, it's by her will that they find her. But she will just get up in the night and just move. And sometimes it would be because she would say there was an astral war going on in that location. And she moved her light there. She was called to be a force of light. So we really don't know what's going on. When Swamiji would teach, especially during the first 20 or 25 years, probably even 30 years that I knew him, he would share these teachings as if he was at war with someone. And I don't mean that he wasn't kind and wonderful and funny, but it was like the force he would put out. And I reflected on it. This is how I wrote it up in my book, Light Bearer, the book Light Bearer. I just felt like Swami was planting, he was fighting the shadow in the causal world, the world of ideas, and he was energizing it through the astral, and it was going to manifest in the material plane. And we were going to absorb it and then, you know, go forward like that. And we did. It worked. I mean, such a power, you know. But very different than us, but at the same time exactly the same as us, you know? So here we are. We're just little seeds becoming an apple tree, all in accordance with God's plan, exactly where we're supposed to be, becoming exactly who we are meant to be. So, my friends, God bless you.